from Searle in Champaign, Illinois, and we're going to shift gears here look at some interesting little critters rather than the plants and the chemistry that we've been looking at before. A lot of you have heard the term species at risk, these are the species that in human terms are in trouble. The Army is interested in species at risk, and you say, well, why do they care about these things? One of the reasons is they have so many of them, and the problem with them is that not only do they have a lot of these uncommon species, but in a lot of cases they have been identified as species that would cause problems with the mission of the installation if they were to progress to the point where they were listed as threatened or endangered. And that's essentially the purpose of performing research in this. Well, why does the Army have a special problem with this? And as a couple of speakers this morning have already said, the reason that we have a problem is we do such a good job of managing our lands. You know, if they were totally degraded and useless, then we wouldn't have these species, but then they wouldn't be usable for training either. There are large parts of these installations that are used only infrequently. That doesn't mean they're not needed, but it means that there are sometimes long waits of many months or a year or more between the times that units actually train out in those areas. And wildlife is attracted to those areas and establishes itself and goes about its business without knowing that it's on Army property. Gee, they'll have to pay more attention to the boundary signs. People have called these species at risk endangered species in waiting, that they've been pre-identified as being sensitive to disturbance. Their populations are decreasing. They've lost their habitat. The Army already has, well, this count keeps changing, the last time I saw it, 259 endangered, threatened, proposed, or candidate species already. 133 installations have these species either on site or on property immediately adjacent to it. And more than 250 species at risk have also been reported. 65 of these are called priority species at risk, and as I said a moment ago, the degree of impact they would cause to the mission if they were listed was the basis for designating them like this. Well, we've used the term candidate species. What do they mean by candidate? Well, it means a species whose continued existence as a species. Now, we don't mean that an individual. There's a difference between individuals and the species. That its existence as a species could become threatened. Therefore, they are candidates to become a listed species, to become a threatened and endangered species. So, how do species at risk become candidates? Well, basically, by continuing to do whatever it was that they did to become a species at risk, continuing to go downhill. And we've already said why the Army is concerned. Now, the federal government has a special set of problems when you're dealing with these species that do become listed as threatened or endangered. Private landowners under the Endangered Species Act have to avoid harm to that species. This includes the issue of harming their habitat and not just avoiding it. But federal landowners have a higher legal responsibility. They not only have to protect the species and their habitat, they have to positively enhance the habitat for those species. So it's a much bigger problem to be responsible for improving the habitat of species once they become listed. Because many of the places that these are located on the military installations, they're fairly critical places that need to be used at certain times. Well, what can be done about it? Can you break this cycle? Well, some people have suggested, well, remove all these species, just get rid of them all. Well, this isn't practical, even if it were legal. Ask for an exemption under the law. An exemption is theoretically available in law, but, oh Lord, the negative PR that would go with asking for an exemption like this is something that has only very rarely been requested. Can we provide enough benefits to these species at risk so it doesn't cross the line to become a candidate? Candidate conservation sounds good. You know, have we ever tried it? Yes, the Army has done it a couple of times on a small scale for species with a very restricted distribution. This little critter down in the corner here, can you see him here? This is the Camp Shelby burrowing crayfish, which is found in one training area in one county in Mississippi on Camp Shelby. And there is a candidate conservation agreement in place among the state of Mississippi and the Forest Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service that says, yes, everything you're doing for this crayfish is exactly what we'd do if it were listing, so there's no need to list it. And that's the whole purpose of trying to implement candidate conservation. It's also been used at Fort Polk for the Louisiana pine snake. Well, that's a little wider area. It's found in about three counties in Louisiana and adjacent Texas. We'll talk about a much wider focus. Now, there's some other things that are available to private landowners. The Safe Harbor Agreement. Scores, hundreds of safe harbor agreements have been formed with private landowners that say, okay, we agree to do these things, and then the Fish and Wildlife Service agrees that even though this is a listed species, you won't be required later to do more. Several of these types of agreements, but federal landowners can't participate. They're specifically excluded in law from participating in these agreements. Gee, that doesn't sound fair, does it? Well, this is Congress. What are you going to do about Congress? Even the people who are coming in are probably less likely to help with this than anybody else. Candidate conservation agreements essentially are agreements that identify these threats, develop measures to conserve them, identify landowners, develop agreements, implement conservation measures, and monitor how well they're working. And that's the secret behind the whole thing. If you're familiar with the Endangered Species Act, those things are exactly what you're supposed to do if you have a listed species. But what happens is that you agree ahead of time to do these same things in the hope, desire, that you can proceed with the activities and maintain the species without it actually being listed. Of course, listing a species doesn't mean you're going to manage it any better. As I say, that not even the Department of Defense can conserve an entire species. If it takes a village to raise a child, it takes a whole state or a whole region to save a species. We did create a region-wide partnership. The focus was on a gopher tortoise. There's a one-year-old tortoise down in the corner there. They're kind of cute when they're small. It started with a memorandum of agreement. The memorandum of agreement arose out of a workshop that was held 5 years ago at Fort Gordon. Essentially, this was a draft, this text got together and said, hey, we're interested in doing a better job for managing this tortoise. Anybody can join. They started signing it in 2006, but we always viewed this as only a first step in the process. And these are the people who eventually joined this memorandum of agreement. And if you see, by gosh, you've got about everybody in the Southeast down there. It was really quite a popular thing. What did we have in mind when we moved on? Well, as I said before, a candidate conservation agreement, and it's very like the text in the memorandum of agreement. The main difference is, as I've noted down there, it creates a legally binding commitment of effort, not just a statement that, hey, this is nice, we'd like to do it, that it's a requirement to provide this information, not just something you can do if you want to. This is the time frame that took place here and a bunch of events in the process. As you can see, there's a lot of steps in everything. And February of last year was when the final signatures in the agreement were obtained. In the implementation of this agreement, it does pretty much what we said before. It organizes these conservation efforts among all the different parties to the agreement so that they're agreeing to the same things and they're doing the same things and reporting them on a regular schedule. Everybody agreed to it. Everybody was on board. But the devil is in the details. When we're dealing with military installations, you know that nothing is simple, those of you who have been involved with it. Installation land management programs have been well established for a decade or more now. They're different on every local location. There may be great freedom given to local management. They're not heavily directed from the top down. Does this mean that we have to have a new NREMP for every installation involved in this? Well, the short answer is no, you don't. The military came up with some different questions, different ideas, and in fact, we had to get the Fish and Wildlife Service to agree to an exception to their standard requirement for a candidate conservation agreement. One of their standard requirements is to report how much land has been permanently protected for the support of that species. And one by one, the attorneys came back from all the military services and said, hey, we can't assure that. Congress is who directs what we have to do and at our installations, so we can't say that this is permanently set aside. The military mission might require that that land be used for something in the future. We don't know. Future is a long time. So they came up with some acceptable wording that the Fish and Wildlife Service has agreed to, and they said, set aside for the purpose of managing the tortoise, and the permanent was taken out. Who manages this? Well, interestingly enough, the state departments of natural resources manage it. Even though the Department of Defense and the Forest Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service are all parties to it, the states are the ones that are in charge of this process. Alabama chaired the group in the beginning, Florida last year, Georgia took over in June of this year. Essentially, the chair of the group has the responsibility to organize the data collection and make recommendations and prepare a report. The first meeting was held in May 2009. The Longleaf Alliance, a private organization, not a governmental organization, was added to the agreement. You can have non-federal and non-government members in this. This was the reporting framework. They standardized the reporting for all the partners. And these are the things that are reported in their annual report. They did this first annual report at the beginning of this year. They had their second annual meeting in June of this year. The results of the first report were that 12 of the 13 members submitted reports. They covered 2.5 million acres of lands that were being managed by the different parties. These are in the part area that it is not listed. Lots of different types of habitat management things were identified. Many different parties reported new survey programs, new monitoring programs. The states of Alabama and Georgia both implemented statewide surveys to try to find out where these species actually existed. note that says 39,000 acres of habitat permanently lost. Some of that was development in Florida. Some of that was at military installations that lost habitat to BRAC development for training ranges and things like that. But it had new legal protection in Alabama, new Forest Service policy for timber sale contracts, new conservation plans for South Carolina. And they made some recommendations for future reporting. One of them turned out to be that the chair needed to know who was the person from that member who was supposed to report. And they forgot to do that at first, and it caused a little confusion. These are the parties to the candidate conservation agreement as of June of this year. Note that one of the federally recognized Indian tribes is a member. All the military services, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, the State Departments of Natural Resources, the Longleaf Alliance, and the American Forest Federation are members of the agreement now. Others, it's still open for other people to join. There's a PWTB that we wrote and prepared on this, and that's now out and available if anybody's interested in looking at it. And I'm down to the end of my time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.